Hello, listeners, and welcome to Sportsville, episode 8. I feel the need for speed. Pace setting and record breaking has been the dominant theme over the past 2 weeks. Adam Peaty broke his 50-metre breaststroke world record twice in one day. Viewing figures for the Lionesses and Euro 2017 have been the biggest ever, but naturally, the most impressive record was that set by Anthony Scaramucci, who was ruthlessly dumped as White House Communications Director by President Donald Trump just 10 days after being installed. Indeed, I have had longer, more successful careers playing as a make-believe character on The Sims. Brian Clough's ill-fated 44-day spell as Leeds United boss also pales into comparison with Mr. Scaramucci. Thankfully, one thing that has been around longer and so far has been far less offensive than the XCOM's director is this podcast. So joining me, Alistair Hooper, as ever to discuss all things sport, is Mr. Will Moulton.
I could be offensive if you want me to be.
I know you can.
I decided not to, though. It's probably best.
Please, thank you.
It's good to be back. Do you know Scaramucci was in charge longer than the gap? Was in charge sort of less time than the gap between these two podcasts.
That's true, actually, isn't it?
That's worrying.
Oh, that's to put it into perspective. In our first half, our sports discussion section, we're going to go through some of the stories that have caught our eye in the last couple of weeks. First up, we're going to talk about the dominance of Adam Peaty. You may have seen his world record-breaking antics at the World Championships in Hungary. Next up, it's the Women's World Cup winning cricketers. And they certainly caught the eye with their last-ditch efforts to win that final. And finally, we'll talk F1 with team orders and driver bickering being the resulting fallout from the Hungarian Grand Prix. Next up in our feature interview section, Will spoke to Rugby World Cup winning flanker Marley Packer about the upcoming World Cup that starts in just a week's time and also juggling the sport with being a plumber. All that and more on Sportsville. Anyway, we're going to dive into the first topic of discussion today, and that's a certain Adam Peaty. The 22-year-old swimmer had a barnstorming time of late, as he successfully retained his 100-metre and 50-metre breaststroke world championship titles. The Staffordshire man also managed to break his own 50-metre world record twice in one day in Budapest. In the semi-final, he became the first man to swim a sub-26 time with 25.95 seconds. Now, he's the holder of Olympic, Commonwealth, European and World 100-metre titles and also the World and European 50-metre titles because, of course, 50 metres isn't an Olympic event. He started relatively late at 14, but he's in pretty good nick, isn't he?
He is, and also, on top of that, he also contributed to the silver in the 4x100 medley as well with an outrageously fast leg. He's just incredible. He just keeps improving. He's in a class of his own as well. I've got some stats here. He won the 100 metres by 1.32 seconds and the 50 metres by over half a second. In terms of, there was a stat the other day, he won the Rio 2016 100 metre breaststroke final in a time that was 2.65% quicker than anyone else. In comparison, when Usain Bolt set the world record, he was only 1.33% faster than anyone else. That is how much of a different class Adam Peaty's in. And you say about there the first person to swim under 26 seconds. That's obviously in the long course pool because Cameron van der Burr has done it a few times in the short course pool. But Cameron van der Burr is a legend of the breaststroke of recent times, and he's nowhere near Peaty. It's just outrageous how talented he is.
He is in a class on his own at the moment, and world dominance really is coming his way. But a mark of the man, really, he's comfortable in the media spotlight. That's very clear. But he's also quite a relaxed individual. I mean, this is one of my favourite quotes he came out with last week, is that the key to his success is keeping everything chilled and watching Modern Family. I've never watched Modern Family, so I don't know if it's as good as it is. But next up on the agenda for him is what they're calling Project 56, and that's to be the first man to go under 57 seconds over 100 metres. The world record, his world record at the moment, is 57.13, which was set at Rio. Do you think he can do that in the near future?
Yeah, if he keeps improving at the rate he is, he's going to do that in the next couple of years. Even without any of these, you know, streamlined suits or anything. Just, I think the one thing that stands him out is his physique. So you get a lot of swimmers, and you see a lot of swimmers, and they're pretty good nick, but Peaty's just at another level. He's properly huge. Like, he could genuinely get away with being a body, look, in terms of looks, people can mistake him as a bodybuilder or something like that, because he's just big all over and he doesn't look like a swimmer. And I think that's, he says he spends so much time in the gym, he has a fantastic diet.
You can see it.
And it's paying off, and I think he's sort of paving the way, and I think he could even be leading into sort of a new era of swimming, where people train differently and spend more time in the gym rather than in the pool. And he's the trendsetter, and let's just hope no one else catches up before long.
Already you can see the difference between him at Rio, his physique there, and,
he wasn't, he wasn't small at Rio.
Oh no, but now he's just a tank.
He is massive, but he's such a lovely guy, and it's clear he says that he likes to keep everything chill, and he does, he enjoys his swimming. I think that's what makes him stand out, is that he enjoys it. I think he obviously takes it seriously, but I don't think, you know, he gets that worked up by it, and he just a nice lad. Just,
oh yeah. Well, I remember reading when he was younger, just starting out in swimming, and it was part of the reason a lot of people fall out of love with it is the early morning starts and setting that alarm clock for 5 o'clock, dragging yourself out of bed to do some swimming before your day properly starts. And there was a time when he wasn't keen on it, he was falling out of love, and it was his mum in the end that persuaded him to take each week at a time and see how he felt. So that was a great piece of advice. He might never have him if he quit.
It's just, and you talk about his mum, but he seems to have a great family support around. His nan has herself become quite famous. She was on the adverts before Rio. She's got her own Twitter account.
She's great, you know, on Twitter.
She's just fantastic, and he just seems to have all that love and support. His life seems pretty perfect at 22, and let's just hope it continues that way, because we want to see him dominate at Tokyo, and then 2024 potentially going on even further than that. So it'll be interesting to see at Tokyo as well. He suggested he could be doing the 200 meter breaststroke. He is has been the national champion in that event. Mark Spitz, though, has come out and said perhaps he shouldn't do it because it might wreck his technique at the shorter events. But, you know, he wants to win multiple gold medals. The 50 breaststroke currently isn't in the Olympic programme, so why not go for the 200 breaststroke?
Absolutely. I'll never, ever knock ambition. And we should really enjoy his dominance while it lasts, because he's 22, but swimmers tend to retire early in comparison to other sports. Rebecca Adlington retired at 23. As a perfect example. I mean, he's not going to go away anytime soon, but there's a high possibility next Olympics might be his last one.
There is a chance, but you never know. But at the moment, you say it was a good championships from the male point of view, but from the female point of view, it was slightly disappointing.
Yes.
So we sort of need people like Petey to keep the others going, and James Guy and Ben Prowl both had good events, but in terms of women, obviously no Jazz Carlin and Amy Walmott, both were injured. Chloe Tutton wasn't selected. Siobhan Marie O'Connor couldn't defend her silver medal in the 200 IM from Rio. So, you know, it wasn't the perfect World Championships, but it's a good sign. There was quite a lot of women and male athletes getting fourth place finishes. Then you look at the other events, we've got 3 diving medals, 2 for Tom Daly, a gold and a silver, 2 synchro mixed gender diving silvers, which is really good, a bronze in the open water swimming. So it's positive. But we need people like Petey now to keep getting better, to keep getting those medals, to encourage others and bring them through. And then, you know, and if the time to do it is now. So hopefully by Tokyo 2020, we'll have an outrageously strong swimming team, and we can put up a decent fight against the likes of the USA, Australia, China. We'll see.
That would be great. And of course, a lot of success here and there that Adam Petey obviously stole the headlines. And he's fast become the poster boy for swimming across the world. But moving on to another success in the last couple of weeks, and that's
the time of it is British supporters.
Just a bit, yeah. This time it's the women's cricketers, who of course won the World Cup and got a brief mention on the last episode, but of course that was before they played their World Cup final. We knew they were in the final, didn't know who against at the time. And last time we mentioned that they'd have to be successful with the bat and the ball. They, of course, weren't, but still managed to win the World Cup. And it was in front of a sold-out Lords. They beat India in dramatic circumstances. Anya Shrubsole was the hero as she took 5 wickets in just 19 balls, which saw India suffer a late collapse after they looked like they might go on and win it. And England ultimately triumphed by 9 runs. Captain Heather Knight said that the win could serve as a springboard for women's cricket, and coach Mark Robinson said it has captured the imagination of everybody as the tournament has gone on. Certainly captured the imagination. You can see the support over social media, the congratulations that went on. I think we're both in agreement that that win can serve as a springboard for the sport.
It's the perfect time. You know, a Women's World Cup on home soil. You know, the support in the stadium when England won. Cricket hasn't seen that in this country since the Ashes in 2005. It was fantastic to see, and they've done it at the best possible time as well, because now you've, in a couple of days' time, you've got the Kia Super League, the second installment of that starting up. It's got so much better coverage, you know, that's going to be all over the place, and people are now going to see these girls and they're going to want to see them play, because you know, the World Cup heroes, and you can go down to your local club and watch a World Cup hero in the KSL, or watch them on TV, or listen to them on the radio. And then with the Women's Ashes coming up this winter back in Australia, England have a good chance of taking that title back. First Women's Day Night Test. Women's cricket at the moment is in a fantastic period in terms of going forward, and now it is with this country as well. And this World Cup success has come at the perfect time. You said before, we said in the last episode they needed to turn up with both bat and ball to win in the same game, to win the tournament, and they didn't do that. But what they did do in that, and Anya Shropshire and Alex Hartley, was had two incredible bowlers who performed when it mattered. Anya Shropshire's spell, as you said, they're 5 wickets and 19 balls. That's going to go down in history as one of the greatest spells that the game of cricket, not just women's cricket, but the game of cricket's ever seen. You've got obviously Stuart Broad, he's had a number of spells. You've got the likes of Dennis Lilly, who's produced amazing spells. Courtney Walsh produced an amazing spell once. Ian Botham, Bob Willis. But Anya Shropshire's definitely got to be in there now. Five wickets and 19 balls in a World Cup final when your team look like they're going to lose, that's another level.
It was impressive. Even I watched it. And I'm not the biggest fan of cricket, as is well known. And a testament, perhaps, to the success of the team is Mark Robinson and his assistant, Ali Maiden, have also been invited to work with the men's team, the test side, ahead of the final test against South Africa. Quite a testament to that. What do you think they can bring?
One thing they really can bring is adaptability. So we saw when Mark Robinson came in 2015, a year later he got rid of Charlotte Edwards. England was struggling all over the place. Got rid of Charlotte Edwards, brought in a new sort of training regime, new approach, and it's fantastic, but it was an attacking game of cricket. But one thing you noticed in that final, especially, was when they were under the cosh, with the bat especially, England knew how to bat sensibly. Sarah Taylor scored 45 runs off at a run a ball and didn't hit a single boundary because she was just playing the percentages game, knocking the ball into gaps. Nat Silver put in a fantastic 51. Jenny Gunn at the end, you know, batted sensibly with Catherine Brunt. And that batting sensibly rather than kamikaze cricket got England to that total, which in the end won them the game. And that's something that England men's side has struggled with in recent times. The second test at Trent Bridge being a prime example. So they can bring that. England showed it in the last test without their help, but that's something that the women are now doing really well, is they can play attacking cricket, but when they need to play sort of sensible cricket, they can, and it's worked. So now Mark Robinson can take that to the men and say, look, we've done that, and this is how I've gone about it, this is how I want you to go about it. Whether Trevor Bayliss likes that or not is another question.
Well, apparently he likes the odd guest coach to come in and share their input. Again, what he brings is what Trevor Bayliss likes.
But it's not quite like different. Eddie Jones, though, is he? Eddie Jones, you know, he's going to all different... I think Eddie Jones was at the Women's Cricket World Cup for some of it. You know, he likes to go and take other ideas of coaches, but Trevor Bayliss seems to be like a person who'd like to do it his way. So it'd be interesting to see, but it's fantastic to see that Mark Robinson, you know, he's won 2 or 3 titles with Sussex as a player and a coach. He's a very experienced man. He knows what he's doing, so having him in that men's setup, it's going to be fantastic. Just hope it doesn't detract from his job with the women now, because they need to kick on. They need to retain. They need to win back the Ashes this winter. That's the next big thing.
They certainly have the talent to do it. And as we said, again, last episode, the hallmark of any great team is that everyone steps up to the plate when needed. And you can't rely on just one individual. And that tournament collectively has shown. I think Tammy Beaumont was player of the tournament, but there were a lot of individual exemplary performances.
There was so many. Sarah Taylor obviously had a good tournament as well. Nat Siver, 200s, that key 50 in the final, she took wickets. Heather Knight chipped in with wickets and runs, perhaps not as many runs as she would have liked. You had Fran Wilson in that semi-final game, produced one of the innings of the tournament. She only got 30, but she saw the side home. Jenny Gunn with bat and ball was incredible, but actually Annie Shrubsall was incredible. But for me, one of the most underrated players in this England side is Alex Hartley. Left arm spinner, she's come in, she's only 23 years old, she's only come in the last couple of years, but every time England needed a wicket in that tournament, she provided. She's just got that knack of, like Moeen Ali, she's got that knack of wicket taking. And she did it, was her actual wicket that sparked the collapse in the final. She removed Harmanpreet Kaur for 51. And then, you know, a few overs later, then Anya Shrubsall went nuts. But Alex Hartley was the one who took that first wicket, and you've got Laura Marsh, and you've got Danny Hazel, you've got such an incredible all-round unit, this England side. They could really go far. They just need to take this form and now build on it. They can't bask in the success of this glory. They need to, you know, make their cricket even better because they're not the finished package. You know, they didn't have a perfect game, so they now need to work out how they can perform with both bat and ball in the same game.
Onwards and upwards, and bring on the Ashes. On to final topic of discussion here, and it's Formula One, and we're talking driver relationships, with both positive and negative stories emerging from the Hungarian Grand Prix over the weekend. We will get into Messrs. Hamilton and Bottas and all things regarding team orders in a memento, but first we're going to turn to driver-related feistiness, and while this wasn't perhaps the headline incident of the race, we like it because of the quotes. And that is the war of words between Haas driver Kevin Magnussen and Renault's Nico Hülkenberg. In the battle for 10th place, Magnussen was handed a five-second penalty for forcing Hülkenberg off the track. And after the race, Hülkenberg approached the Haas driver and sarcastically congratulated him for being once again the most unsporting driver. Magnussen in turn responded by saying, I'm toning this quote down slightly, suck my spherical nether regions, honey. Translation, it's balls. That got a little bit feisty at the end, really, didn't it?
Pathetic on both parts. I thought Magnussen's comment was hilarious, but childish, and it's something I would say. Whereas...
yes, it was.
It's very much something I'd say. Whereas Hülkenberg, you know, there was... especially in front of all the media guys, what's the point? You know, just leave it, cool down. Hülkenberg had already been involved with Magnussen's teammate Romain Grosjean at the start, bumping him into the air at turn one, ruining Grosjean's race. And Magnussen had already said, if Hülkenberg's not going to get penalised and going to play dirty, then he's going to have it coming to him. And sure enough, Magnussen ran him off the road. But Magnussen, it was an over-aggressive move. He didn't need to run him quite so wide, but he didn't make contact with him. I think, you know, 5 second penalty was fair enough. It wasn't necessarily a racing incident, but it wasn't anywhere near as bad as the move Hülkenberg pulled at the start of the race. And Hülkenberg, I like him as a driver. He's very undervalued. He should be with a better team, but sometimes his personality just lets him down a little bit. Moments like this, there's just no point. It's great for us as fans, you know.
And great headline.
Magnussen's
as well.
Response is fantastic. But it was just it's a bit pathetic, and they could have dealt with it the way the Red Bull guys dealt with their situation.
Exactly.
That was quite well done in the
Speaking
end.
Speaking of which, those two drivers, another pair who came to blows during the race were the Red Bull teammates, Daniel Ricciardo and Max Verstappen. Drivers collided on the second corner of the first lap of the race, which forced Ricciardo out, and the Australian called Verstappen's driving amateur, to say the least.
And a sore loser.
The young Dutchman has obviously apologised for his actions. It wasn't on purpose, but it was a clear mistake, and it's something else he needs to learn from, really.
I think initially Ricciardo was very hacked off, and rightly so. His teammates driven into him, we called him a sore loser, but then it all was down to Max and how Max responded. And he's 19 years old, we all know he could be a bit of a hothead at times, but in all credit to him, he came out and just said straight away, sorry, it was his mistake, he didn't mean it, he just, you know, made an error and ran into him. And you know, that's fair enough, and they've dealt with it really well. They've dealt with it in-house. Ricciardo says it's all fine, they've moved on. Obviously there's going to be a little bit of needle because they've crashed, but you know, that happens. But you know, all credit to Max. You know, he's growing up very fast. He's actually becoming, I didn't like him initially at first because of his hot-headedness, but the way he's dealt with all the retirements and the issues he's had this year, and now the way he's dealt with this, you know, he's fast becoming a very mature, grown-up driver, and he's becoming a very likeable driver as well.
That's a perfect example of how to shut down any potential feud that could brew with Red Bull, and they are two very likeable people. I'll struggle to find anyone who dislikes Daniel Ricciardo, because the guy always has a smile on his face. But I'm a little bit opposite to you, I suppose, and I've always liked Max Verstappen because of his daringness on the track. It can occasionally come off for the worst, such as this, but that's what makes him exciting, I think, to fans. And I hope it doesn't diminish his sort of the risks he takes.
He's a fantastic driver, I always said that. Just sometimes his personality and his arrogance has been a little bit, you know, standoffish, but he's growing up. He was young, he was very talented, and he knew it, so you've got to give that to him. And yeah, well, he's a bloody good driver. Some of his defences may be a little bit dangerous at times, but you know what, that's part of the fun of it. That's why we tune in every week to watch it.
He is good. But I did pass my driving tests younger than he did. So, just saying. But on to the main talking point, which was, of course, team orders. Lewis Hamilton was allowed to pass teammate Valtteri Bottas during the race because he felt he had the pace and he wanted to try and overtake the two Ferraris who were running first and second ahead of them. Hamilton promised to give third place back to Bottas if he couldn't, and he was true to his word and let him pass on the final corner. It was certainly honourable, but if you were fighting for the Drivers' Championship, would you have done the same thing?
Well, everyone else seems to forget that Bottas is also in with a chance. I don't think Hamilton forgot that. I think that's why he let him back through. And, you know, fair play again to Hamilton. He didn't have to do that. He put himself under pressure from Verstappen by doing that. So I think it was unselfish, and 3 points at the end of the day might make all the difference, but in terms of keeping the teammate happy and everything, and he's only 14 points behind. What, it would have been 11 points behind, he still would have been behind. And he'd already said that give me the opportunity. Valtteri had no, and then he said, I'll be happy to give the place back. Valtteri had no hesitation, let Hamilton through, just screwed up his own race slightly by doing it, running so wide at turn one. And Hamilton honoured that promise because he'd seen that Bottas had given him the chance, and it's clear those two get on well, and Bottas still has a chance of the title. That's what everyone seems to forget, and it's really frustrating. He's won two Grand Prix. You know, there's been a couple of races where he's been off the pace, but there's been some races where he's been fantastic. So he's definitely not out of it yet. And I think Hamilton knew that, and also for the Constructors' title as well. Obviously, it didn't matter because they would have scored the same points, but I think it was a good move from Hamilton. If it screws up his chances, will it screw up his chances? I don't think 3 points will matter that much. We'll see.
Well, again, yeah, we'll see. But onto sort of the wider issue of team orders themselves. I accept that they're a part of F1, and F1 is primarily a team sport. I, however, don't like them. I think F1 should purely be about racing, and this goes further than that. In an ideal world, I would like to see one driver per team, so that you don't get team orders, and so that team resources can be put into one driver to make them as fast as they possibly can be. But that's my opinion.
You're never going to get that.
It's never going to happen, I know. I'm talking in ideal fantasy land. But where do you stand on team orders as a principle, really?
Team orders are controversial. They always have been, they always will be. And when used incorrectly, they look really rubbish. But when used correctly, and I'd say they were used correctly this weekend by Mercedes to give Hamilton a chance. Hamilton was, take a championship standings out of it, Hamilton was the quicker car. Hamilton, Bottas was never going to overtake the Ferraris, and Hamilton had a chance. So I don't see the issue with that. It's the issue when it's more for the lead of a race, or when Barrichello was ordered to move aside for Schumacher back into the 2000s. You know, it was, when it's poorly used, it's controversial. And there was a time when it was banned. It's now been brought back, and you don't actually hear that much of it, to be honest. A lot of teams just let the drivers race. Red Bull let the drivers race. Ferrari don't, but they're slightly more subtle. Kimi Raikkonen was the faster car this weekend, but he knows his place in the team, and he knew he was not going to be allowed to go fast.
That's the bit I find annoying. Kimi has
Ferrari,
shown that he could compete up there.
Ferrari are battling for the World Championship. Raikkonen isn't going to win the Drivers' Championship. Vettel might, so I can see why they did it. I mean, obviously it wasn't as clear, their use of it, but Raikkonen was a good half a second a lap quicker. But yeah, I think team orders when used well is fine. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I'm still not so sure. I get it's totally fine in the current setup, and to do what they did with Kimi is okay, but I just would love to see the two of them actually go at it for once, rather than being told no,
also
calm down.
The nature of the cars, it's hard to fight if you've got two cars that are even. We saw that as soon as Hamilton closed up, there's a fairly even pace of Ferraris. He couldn't get past because of the way these cars are, the width and the aerodynamics and everything. So it is making it harder to pass. Sometimes in those cases, if you've got a driver who's quicker behind but can't get past because he's in the same car, you're going to have to use team orders, and that's what Mercedes did. Mm-hmm. And in the end, it didn't work. But Bottas still got the podium, so all's well that ends well.
Hey ho, I'm still living in fantasy land. The closest I've found to my ideal world is Mario Kart, so it's all good. But that concludes this first section on this episode of Sportspiel, but stick around, of course, because we have our feature interview section coming up with Marley Packer. And to introduce our guest, I'm going to bring in the person who did the interview.
So Marley Packer, in terms of women's rugby, is one of the best players in the world at the moment. She was a key part of the side that recently toured New Zealand. They beat Australia, Canada and New Zealand in the Black Ferns backyard for the first time since 2001. In order to move up to the number one in the world rankings for the first time in England women's history, the Red Roses are defending the World Cup that they won in 2014. Later this month in Ireland, Marley Packer came into the side after Maggie Alfonsi's retirement and has been a mainstay ever since. She has a slightly strange story in that she is also a plumber on the side, so she's not one of these players that plays sevens. When this World Cup ends, she's going to go back to plumbing, so we talked to her about that. We talked about starting the game, and it's a slightly shorter interview than normal, but it's a fantastic interview, aside for the bit where the signal goes a bit dodgy. But, you know, it's because I was in Cornwall, so what can you expect?
Perfect warning.
Welcome back, listeners, to another episode of Sportspiel, where once again it is time for our feature interview. This week we are lucky enough to be joined by England flanker and World Cup winner Marley Packer. Welcome to the show, Marley.
Hi.
So for those of you who may have missed it, the Lions aren't the only side to have toured New Zealand recently, as the England women's side recently returned from a three-match series in the country in which they recorded victories over the hosts, Canada and Australia, to put themselves top of the world rankings for the first time ever, with just over a month to go until they defend their World Cup title. Marley in particular had a fantastic tour, capped off with a stunning display against New Zealand, which saw her grab a try, and was also named the Mixed Zones Action Woman of the Month. Congratulations on the accolade, Marley, and how did the tour go from your perspective?
Oh, it's just like a fantastic tour, coming back from New Zealand, winning three games from three, and obviously put us in great stead, ready for the World Cup coming up in August.
And when you went into the tour, you're obviously playing the number one side in the world before then, and Canada and Australia. Did you expect to win all three games?
No, not all. Like, I think that was always our goal, to go out there and win all three games. I think cause whenever you go out there to play a close game, you're going out there to win. But I think for us it was to see where we're at before heading into the World Cup in August.
And that victory against New Zealand was a pretty tight game as well. So it must have felt great to come away with a victory from it.
Oh yeah, most definitely. Getting the first try and then going down two tries to get a comeback, and the way we did and how we came out at halftime, just firing, knowing that we wanted to beat New Zealand in New Zealand the first time in a long time. Something that we just decided as a group that it was going to happen.
And you scored, as a team, three tries from mauls from attacking lineouts. You have a very strong forward pack at the moment. Is that something that you really think is going to help you in going into the World Cup then?
Oh, yeah, I think that's a point of difference for us in England squad. Us as forwards, we've got some amazing players from 1 to 8 that have all around the park are incredible. But when we come together, we're in that gold zone, blue zone week for us, that we want to come out with points, then that's where we pick. That's what we pick to do the driving role. We know our jobs and our roles, and they've got to stop us getting over the line.
But if that obviously doesn't go well for you, you also have a fantastic back line as well. Is this arguably one of the most complete attacking sides ever that you've ever played in?
Yeah, most definitely. Obviously, I was part of a 2014 squad that won the World Cup, and I think that the game's evolved since then, and the players have evolved with it. The stuff we do away from just being on the training pitch is massive for us, and it gives us those extra percenters that makes us the incredible team that we are.
And you mentioned there the 2014 World Cup. Obviously, you are defending champions, but going back 3 years to the start of that World Cup, did you ever think you would come out as overall winners?
Yeah, most definitely. That was our goal, to go into that World Cup and win it. And I can remember sitting there in 2010 and watching the girls lose the final against New Zealand and going to my mum that I want to be in the next World Cup final and we're going to win it. And to actually do that and get a starting shirt was something very special for me, something I always remember. And now to get the chance to go out and do it again with a different group of some very special players and unique players who again get the chance to win a gold medal is something that I'm driving to, and I know the rest of the squad is.
And you yourself had a fantastic World Cup in 2014. You were England's joint highest scorer with four tries. You played really well. Again, was that something you were expecting to come out as the top try scorer?
No, not all. Like, it's always a bonus when you get yourself on the top of the try scorer list. Scoring sheet as it was, but I think that's just a show of what great teams have around you. It's not just individual players that gets you tries. It's the training, the moves, the plays that you decide to do as a team, and that works against different teams, that it's going to hit you that. Like, I'd never thought I'd be a joint try score. I never thought I'd be a joint point scorer with our winger Kay Wilson at that time. No.
You mentioned there Kay Wilson. Obviously, she's coming off the back of that world record try-scoring feat in the recent Six Nations as well. Are we likely to, we're likely, therefore, to see more tries from her? Is there anyone else maybe that we might...
Most definitely. Like, obviously, when the time is for the forwards to let the ball go out for the back, then I'm sure Kay Wilson will be on the end of that and be scoring tries from left, right and centre. Like, she's a fantastic player. I think we'd definitely be seeing tries from her.
And is there any other players from the England side that you think, as fans, we should be really on the lookout for? Not necessarily for tries, but just for overall general performance.
I think, like, in your back rows, you've got the likes of Alex Matthews, Sarah Hunter. You've got the young, we've got a young player, Sarah Byrne, now coming up through. At prop, she's had a fantastic tour in New Zealand, and really put a stead into it. Getting a starting shirt for the World Cup. Then in your backs, you've got your Katie McLean, who's just a fantastic player on and off the field. Her knowledge is second to none, and she's so passionate about the game. Then Emily Scarrett, she's a fantastic player, world class, and she's very humble about that, which is fantastic to have around you. But I'd say 1 to 15, 1 to 28 of us, all fantastic players, and every single one is one to watch out for, because when you get to a World Cup tournament, everybody ups their game, so you don't know who's going to come out flying.
And you mentioned that all 28 players as a squad. After the 2014 World Cup, the full-time contracts for all the players were brought in. How much of an impact has that had on the English game in general, having to be able to play full-time?
Well, those contracts were actually for sevens players, so a lot of the 15th players only got full-time contracts in January.
Okay.
So it's just been eight months, and then the contract actually ends on the 31st of August. So I think that 8 months, those players have just managed to get the rest and recovery in instead of having to go out to work, because it's not a time when they've not trained as hard as what everyone else has when they've had to work.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's going to be that point of difference for us that we've been able to do this.
Yeah. And at the time of the 2014 World Cup, it was well publicised that you were still a plumber, and you went back to work a few days later. How is being able to balance sort of being a plumber alongside being an England player?
I think the company I work for, HomeServe, they're a very supportive company. Since the 2014 World Cup, I've still worked for them and alongside them. After 2014 World Cup, I went straight away. And to be honest with you, it's going to have to be staying this time around. I won't have very much time before I go back and work. So I'm looking forward to it, because at the same time, it's another challenge to respect. But all my concentration's going on to this World Cup in we need to win every one of them to bring home that trophy again.
And you yourself, you've been playing rugby since the age of five. How did you first get into the game when you were that age?
My mum's friends took me to play one day.
Mm-hmm.
I had a pair of jeans and a red funny top, because my mum thought I was going to actually watch, not play. Mm-hmm. I came back kicked in mud, and I didn't pick it up clean again and went in the bin, so that was a result for me. And I never really looked back. I played rugby then. Obviously, I played different sports through school, but rugby
And when you were playing rugby, was it with the boys or were there girls' teams?
No, so it was mixed up to the age, I think, of 13. And mm-hmm. then it had to be girls' teams. And I stayed with the same club, Yeovil Barbarians, which is now known as Yeovil Rugby Club, mm-hmm. Up to the age of 13. And then from there, when I went into set up and moved across to Bath Ladies, played a couple of years at Bath, which I really enjoyed it. It was great to start that kind of level of rugby before then changing across to
Was there any was there a particular moment when you were sort of coming up through the age groups and whatever you thought I could actually make this as a career, or did you always have sort of your heart set on that?
I think at the time, the career bit was I knew I could make it as a rugby player, but there wasn't really a career option in it back then. So for young players these days, looking at like 16 plus, that like there are contracts out there to be grabbed for sevens and different things, whereas back when I was that age there wasn't. So the first time any kind of contract was talked about was in 2013 for the Sevens World Cup, which was a part-time contract. So mm-hmm. and then when I got contracted for that was just a massive, I couldn't believe it that they'd even asked me. So I always knew that I would kind of make it to play for England if I kept on training and doing what I was doing. But to get a contract and actually be paid for something that I love doing, I never believed it.
And obviously, before that contract, you played your first game for England back in 2008 as an 18-year-old. How was the occasion for you?
Oh, it's incredible. Like, it was a massive surprise at the time. The England Under 20s program. It was a call from everywhere. So a lot of people got their first taps in that game. But mainly like age players or senior 20 players. I was one of the youngest. It was an incredible time. One I'll never forget. But then it was another 3 years, 3 months, so I got my second cap. And my second cap was a lot more rewarding for me because I worked hard for it. I wanted it.
And those 3 years, 3 months in between caps, it must have been quite a frustrating time. How did you just sort of knuckle down and think, I'm just going to have to keep working hard and force my way back in?
Yeah, most definitely. Like, there was lots of factors and reasons why. In that time, I became a qualified plumber. Mm-hmm. So I needed to concentrate on that. In that time, I still was interested in the England setup, so I stayed in the under-20s for another 2 years. I went across to A. And then actually in 2012, out in Canada, and that was to get my second cap. And when that came about, beforehand, that tour, I was involved in that tour, but to go out there, and then I think I started in every game for England right up to the end of 2012. We got the final, we beat New Zealand in the Ultimate Internationals, which was brilliant. Of course, those players, and I just think that year was quite a significant year and always a memory that I have, as in my second cap was very, very special to me.
Mm-hmm. And then obviously since then you've been a fairly regular in the side, and then we'll skip forward to the Grand Slam this year because I'm aware you don't have too much time with me. First Grand Slam since 2012, you had that sort of tough opening first half against France, but then in the first game, but then after that the side was unstoppable. I take it was almost the perfect tournament for the team.
Oh yeah, most definitely. And I think even it was the perfect start, maybe, need tough competition, that's what it's about, and to fast improve in what we're training and our processes, that was kind of massive to have to get some of those challenges. And I think that a bit of research on what we do is good and right, we broke it down and we got that next day.
And final question for me, obviously going into defending champions, you're number one in the world. Do you realistically think you can defend your title in Ireland?
Definitely.
Definitely, that's very confident. Well, thank you so much for your time, Marley.
Thank you.
I wish you all the best, and yeah, I'll let you know when all the pieces are out. But thank you very much.
Thanks again to Marley for taking part in that interview, and we'd just like to take this moment to remind you that you can follow us on social media. That's Sportsbuild Pod. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and on Facebook. And of course, you can email us feedback@sportsbuildpod@gmail.com.
That's all for this week. We'll see you in a fortnight.
Farewell all.